Okay, good afternoon, everybody. So I'm really going to be talking about basically a series of experiments that look at the feasibility of an approach to improving stereoscopic displays, multifocal plane displays. So I think this audience is very familiar with the basic problem that we're addressing here. In the natural world, you focus, you accommodate, and converge your eyes at the same point in space as you look around three-dimensional scenes. And of course, what we normally do in stereoscopic displays is stick some single display surface up, and now we require frequently these two systems to be decoupled. You know, have to converge at one distance and accommodate at the screen if you want to have a clear image, and you have to stay accommodated at the screen as you continue then to make convergence eye movements around the scene. And of course, it's well known and has been for a long time that these two responses are neurally coupled. They drive one another synergistically, and there's benefits to the system of doing that, but there's effort required to overcome that coupling and to decouple them to look at stereoscopic images. Sometimes you can't do it, sometimes you can, but it causes various, what you might call, aversive or unwanted side effects. And these are all studies which have specifically isolated just the accommodation vergence component and manipulated that and shown that it's related to causing discomfort and fatigue. That's been talked about a lot in this meeting, but there are other things that are a consequence of this also, which I think are important. So there are effects on stereo depth perception. It takes longer to fuse stereoscopic images, and your precision of stereo depth perception, your stereo acuity, goes down under these conditions. There's also some small but reliable effects of distortions in perceived depth from having the accommodation distance, the distance you focus that, be incorrect. Specify the screen surface, not the three-dimensional structure of the scene. And I think there are probably some other perceptual effects that are less explored to do with having sort of natural relationships between when you focus the eye at different distances and things go in and out of focus as you look around the scenes. Those things are not preserved in normal stereo displays. So the sort of essence of the multifocal plane display approach is, well, can you do something about solving these problems by presenting a continuous, or at least something approximating a continuous, variation in focal distance as you get in the real world? So in principle, the idea is really quite simple. You just sample the focal variation in the scene with multiple display planes. There's a few different ways that you could do this technically, and what it's been done technically so far. There's methods using mirrors and beam splitters, which is the way we do it in the lab. I'll talk about that. And there's also been various adaptive optics approaches where at high speed, as the image is drawn, you set some power of some optical system to a different focal distance, draw that part, set it to a different focal distance, draw that part. But conceptually, they create the same thing, which is a bunch of transparent displays stacked up in front of one another, and the eyes see the sum of images drawn at all of these focal planes. So kind of the sort of critical design parameter here then really is, how many planes do you need, or how far apart should they be spaced? If you have a million focal planes, you effectively have the real world and the problems are all solved, but you can't build something that has a million focal planes and will actually work. So you need to try to minimize the number of planes that you use while still having an acceptable outcome. And there's a few things you can sort of do a priori that suggest that this might be a tractable approach. You have to fix the viewpoint, so this is not a general kind of approach that can work for TV and movies and so on, but for more specialist applications, something where you look into a viewing device or you wear a head-mounted display or similar. But by fixing the viewpoint, you can take advantage of the fact that we know that the eye's sensitivity to focal depth is relatively poor compared to its spatial sensitivity. So you already know that you need relatively few planes, focal planes, compared to the resolution that you need spatially, the pixel resolution that you need at each image plane. So that suggests there might be some mileage in this approach. Because the amount of blur in the retinal image is related to how defocused you are in diopters, which is distance expressed as the reciprocal of distance in meters, the right way to space these planes is equally spaced in dioptric distance, and so you need relatively few planes to cover physical distances that are far away, but as you get closer and closer, you need to stack them up more tightly so that you can sort of know that ahead of time. But if you just take the kind of simple approach of saying, well, we'll just sample this space densely enough that we always put planes within the depth of focus of the eye, the answer for a sort of general display comes out as suggesting you need something like 14 image planes, which is too many for the current systems. And in any case, the more planes you have, the more computations you have to do each time you draw the image. So you want to try to minimize that if you can. So that kind of suggests this sort of back of the envelope calculation that this is not a tractable approach. And then Kurt Akeley made the point that when you have a multi-plane display like this, you need some kind of a decision rule to assign image intensity to different image planes. So let's say there's two planes here, and you're trying to present this object here. You need a rule that says, for this point in the image, where am I going to put the light? And what we showed in a SIGGRAPH paper in 2004 is if you take a simple rule where you just say, well, we'll put the light for this part on the nearest plane, so we'll put it here. We'll put the light for this part on the nearest plane, so we'll put it here. You get visible discontinuities in the image. And so the relatively simple conceptual solution to that is to just linearly interpolate in terms of image intensity. So this is variously called depth-weighted blending or depth filtering. And the rule's quite simple. You just, along different lines of sight, for each point in the image, you apportion image intensity to each plane according to the relative distance of the point from each plane. So you're distributing image intensity across planes. In dioptric distance is the right way to do that, by the way. So we're exploring the idea of whether or not this can actually create a continuous variation in focal distance. And if that sounds a little bit fanciful, you can take a more principled approach that suggests that it's not. So there's lots going on in this graph, but what this shows is this is based on a measurements of the optics of a real person's eye, and we're computing what the retinal image looks like when they look at these depth-filtered stimuli versus looking at real objects. So what's shown on the x-axis here is basically the defocus, or where you're accommodated relative to the distance that we're presenting the stimulus at. And on the y-axis here is the amount of contrast, the ratio of contrast at the retina compared to the contrast in the world. So how much is contrast attenuated by the eye's optics? So the dashed lines here show the retinal contrast you get as you sort of sweep your focus through a range. To a real object that's positioned where this vertical dashed line is. And of course, what you find is that you get the maximum contrast on or around focusing at the correct distance, in inverted commas. And of course, with increasing spatial frequency, so increasingly fine scale information, there's overall attenuation of the amount of contrast in the retinal image. And then what the solid lines show here is this depth-filtered approximation to the same thing. So what we've done now is put 50% of the light energy at a plane here, 50% of it here, and you see you get a very similar pattern of changes in contrast. So you do get peaks in the middle where you would want to have them for the eye to be able to focus there. So that suggests this might actually work. You might be able to have continuous variations in focal distance. Of course, where it starts to break down is if you put the planes farther apart. As I said before, when they're extremely close together, it's a very close simulation to the real world. So these are exactly the same data, except now the solid lines show the depth-filtered equivalent with planes farther apart, and you see there's a lot of attenuation of contrast here, and especially at these mid-range frequencies, whereas here there was something for the accommodation system to latch onto and say, right, here's the maximum, I need to focus here. There's nothing here, so it's possible the system just won't know where to focus, and the approach won't work. So what we've done over a couple of years is a series of experiments looking at different sort of metrics for whether or not this approach works. And the concept is very simple, and it's the same for all the experiments. We have we vary the distance between planes, and we present images using this depth filtering technique. And we see the effects on these different kinds of measures. So we've measured the accuracy of the accommodation and vergence responses to these stimuli. And what we've done just recently is measure aspects of the quality of stereo depth perception from these depth-filtered images. And critically here, you have to have a real-world control stimulus. So you need to be able to put a stimulus up at the same distance as the distance that you're simulating when you're presenting these depth-filtered stimuli, so that you have everything else controlled. The demand on the accommodation system, demand on the vergence system, and so on is constant across conditions. That's an important control. So what that requires then is a display where we can move around our focal planes. And you might not necessarily build it that way as a practical device or a product or something, but we have to do that in the lab. So the way that we've done that is the following way. So here's an eye. This is a side view of one eye's display. Here's a monitor, and it's very simple. We just have a mirror here and beam splitters here and here. And if we put an image on this part of the screen, it follows a long optical path. If we put it on this part, it follows a shorter optical path. So what you end up with is image planes like this at different distances, and then they're all mounted on an optical rail, so we can just move them around in different conditions in experiments. A little detail of this, this is built as a Bedal optometer, so it has this lens here, and the eyes at the focal length of the lens. And one of the properties that has that's very useful is it means that we can present objects up to optical infinity in this display, even though it's a small physical display. And I can talk to people about how that works afterwards if you're interested. It has some other advantages too. And notice that this eye here is looking through this box, which is an autorefractor, which is an ophthalmic instrument for measuring where the eye is focused. And then this thing's built as a stereoscope, so the right eye sees one display through the autorefractor here, and the left eye sees another identical display via a mirror, so we can present stereoscopic images. And then we also have an eye tracker, an eye link system that measures the vergence state of the eyes. So we can do psychophysics experiments, but we can measure accommodation and vergence responses at the same time. And here's just a picture of what the thing looks like to prove we actually built it. I'm not making it all up. So what we've done in the past, and these results have been reported at this meeting, is to measure accommodation and vergence responses as a function of image plane separation. And what we basically found is with image planes separated up to about 0.9 diopters, you basically get responses that you can't distinguish from responses to real-world stimuli. So here's simulated distance on this axis. Here's the accommodation response. Here's the positions of two image planes. And what you see is for all the different simulated distances in between, you get a nice linear accommodation response. So we can now continuously vary the focus response along with the vergence response. And more recently, we've been examining the dynamics of both vergence and accommodation responses. And as I say, up to about 0.9 diopters, we can't tell the difference between them. So the latency, the onset times, the velocity of vergence and accommodation all seem very equivalent with plane separations like this. When you go bigger, things start to break down. So that kind of seems like a win for the approach, because it means you would only need four image planes to be able to cover this really large range of physical distances. So that seems kind of promising. But I just want to return to this figure again. I pointed out to you that there's a big attenuation here in the amount of contrast that you get in the images, and this is a spatial frequency dependent effect. So at high spatial frequencies, there's very little contrast left. So you're losing fine-scale information in the images increasingly as you separate the planes and put them farther and farther apart. And other people have made this point too. So it's likely that that's going to have an effect on stereo depth perception. It's known that reducing contrast affects stereo acuity. And if you're losing fine-scale spatial information, you'd expect that that might happen. And this is just a figure that sort of summarizes data from the previous figures. Here we have, again, this retinal contrast ratio. For a stimulus that's midway between two planes, and just as a function of plane separation, this is how the contrast falls away. So by this sort of 0.9 value that I talked about, I think a line will come up there, I'm saying this is fine for driving the accommodation and vergence responses correctly, but it's a quite sort of impoverished stimulus relative to a natural stimulus. So the most recent experiments we've done are very simple. They follow the same kind of logic, but we've measured aspects of stereo depth perception. So we've used a well-known task that people have used in the past. This is just a cartoon, but we present a stereoscopic corrugation in depth that's defined by a random dot stereogram, and that can have a different orientation to the left or to the right, and the person's task is to say what the orientation is. So if they can't see depth in it, they can't do the task, they're guessing. And if they can, they do better than chance at the task. And then we measure thresholds for a couple of things. We've measured how we vary the presentation time to find out how long they need to see the stimulus to have stereo fusion. So it's a sort of time to fusion measure. And then we also measured stereo acuity or stereo resolution. We vary the spatial frequency to find out the sort of finest modulation in stereo depth that people can see with these depth-filtered stimuli. And then we just do the same experiment. We again vary the plane separation, including critically having this real-world stimulus where all the image intensities are one plane. It's a plane, almost planar stimulus. So, and here's what we find. This is image plane separation again, and this is time to fuse. And we find there's really very little effect of fusion time on of this putting the planes farther and farther apart. There's a little bump at the end here, but in terms of the actual magnitude of the effect, it's very small. And that's kind of consistent with the idea that up to quite large plane separations, the vergence and accommodation responses are going as rapidly as they normally do as well. And of course, any image blur can actually help stereofusion, so maybe there's a sort of a counteracting effect here. But with stereo acuity, things are a little bit different. They fall off sooner. So you see that after sort of about 0.6 diopters, there's a drop-off in stereo acuity as you put the planes farther and farther apart. So as we expected, there is a hit, and this is just an empirical test to say, well, where does that occur on this sort of plane separation dimension? So where do we end up then? It looks like stereo acuity is the limiting factor in stereo depth perception with these depth-filtered images rather than any of the sort of ocular motor components. They're fixed sooner with a much larger plane separation, but you need a smaller plane separation if you want to have real-world equivalent stereo acuity. However, with image plane separations of 0.6 diopters, you do get that. So you get equivalent stereo acuity and all these other things that we've measured as if you were viewing a real-world stimulus. And the good news there is that suggests that you'd only need 5 image planes to be able to represent everything from infinity to about 40 centimeters. So that seems like that might be tractable with developments of current approaches. It's worth saying, of course, that you still do lose high-frequency information. There's no way of getting around that. So if that's very critical to the task, say a medical imaging task, for example, then you wouldn't be able to use image plane separations as large as this, and there'll be some hit on the perceived image quality because you lose those high frequencies. That said, I think in many specialist applications where we imagine this type of approach might be useful, like a surgical device or something, the range of physical distances you need to represent is actually much smaller than the range here. So you could have the same number of planes, but stack them closer together. So overall then, with a couple of those sort of caveats, we think this suggests that this does seem to be a reasonably tractable approach. The answer of how many planes you need or how far apart they need to be is a reasonable number. That means you could probably build sensible displays that will work quite well. And these are the folks that did the hard work from my lab and David Hoffman, who's was at Marty Banks' lab at the time. And I'll stop there. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Watts. Any question or comments? Nicolima?
Hi, Simon. So what's the brightness of this display? And have you measured the effect of brightness on stereo resolution with it?
That's a good question. Ours is quite low. So it's something like 12 candelas per meter squared. It's not quite answering the question you asked, but one of the problems with all of these approaches, which I didn't talk about, is the more planes that you have, the dimmer the display gets. So our system is subtractive, so the more beam splitters you stick in the way, the darker the images get. And techniques that use adaptive optics, the more planes you have, the shorter the duty cycle of each plane. So that's another reason why you want to make the thing have as few planes as possible. But the results we have, I guess you're asking, are they generalizable to all kinds of different situations and not completely, no.
How about one more? Please tell your name and abbreviation.
Frédéric Duvernay from INRIA. It seems like in your experimental setup, the planes for the left and right eye are not the same. They are slanted with respect to each other. So do you think it influences the results?
No, it's a good question. So you don't have to do it that way. So you could have even the same plane that's viewed via shutter glasses or something like that, or you could have them optically superimposed. Actually, we have a choice in our display. So we can rotate the monitors around, so we can change different aspects of eye position independent from disparity. How it ends up is we normally, to get the right field of view, we converge the monitors at a distance that's about halfway through the dioptric range of the distances we can present. And so the difference between the angle of the sort of slant of the image planes relative to the two eyes is almost nothing. It's tiny. And compared to, the focus, there is a sort of small focus error, but it's absolutely minute. It's fractions of a diopter.
Okay. So... Last one. please.
Which one?
Okay. Behind.
This gentleman?
The, yeah. Sorry.
I don't know if my question is pertinent or not, but could you have an adaptative multi-plane, like if you have a closed subject, 3D subjects, and then you can move all the five planes relatively closer,
yeah,
to have a more precise depth perception, and other subjects to have it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's right. So you don't have to. I mean, we're sort of trying to generate the worst case scenario values for if you need to cover all of the usable range you might want a virtual reality device to cover. So from here to the moon. If that's not what you need to do, then you can just stack things closer together. And it's pretty trivial to use some optical solution to even have a fixed set of planes that you just move the whole thing around to nearer and farther distances. So it's certainly tractable. I mean, some of the constraints are the smaller you make everything and to put it in a smaller box, and the more that you have to motorize things and all those types of things, you can get difficulties with alignment, and you can get difficulties getting the person aligned accurately relative to the optics of the device. So you need to be a little bit careful. It's kind of why we've built it as this large Meccano set thing, because then it's relatively easy to position everything. So your manufacturing tolerances and things would have to be very good. But yeah, in principle, I don't see why not.
Okay, last one.
To prepare images for this, you need to know the depths of the objects. Okay, so you'd have to do depth map.
Yeah.
Okay.
So our the reason it's done the way that it, well, not the reason it's done the way that it is, it uses, partly because Kurt Akeley was involved in the initial development of this, he was always thinking about how OpenGL operates. And so you use the information from the ZBuffer and OpenGL to do these calculations. And they're not very difficult calculations to do. But yeah, for anything that's, you know, live action filmed or something where you don't know the depth map, you can't apply it. You need to calculate the depth map in order to do it. That's right. So it's really for computer generated imagery.
Okay, let's move to next speaker. Thank you.